is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We greatly appreciate everybody taking time today to join us for another edition of Midrats. And if you are with that esteemed cohort that is with us live, if you are so inclined, I'd like to extend an invitation to you to join us in the chat room. You can find that over at the bottom of the show page. And if you have some observations you would like to share during the course of the show, or there's a question you would like for us to address to our guest, that's a great place to put it. We'll be monitoring that during the entire course of the show. And if you've got to leave halfway through the show, or if you're following this link later to the podcast, remember, if you ever want to make sure that you get every opportunity to see what our guests have to say on the threats, go over to iTunes, Spreaker, whatever podcast aggregator you use, and go ahead and subscribe to the free podcast on iTunes. That way, we'll always be waiting for you at a time to your convenience. And moving on to today's show. When you look at the different standards related to intellectual property, how that influences things in the civilian world, when you first look at it, it may not be obvious there's a tie-in and a history there when it comes to the defense industry and national security, to the point of how nations actually defend and build up their industrial bases, especially in dual-use areas. What we're going to look at today is how all this ties in with respect to law, process, and customs of various cultures and nations to eventually decide what shows up on the battlefield for both our friends and our potential challengers. And in a return visit to Midrats, our guest today is Dr. Robert Farley, and we're going to use as the starting point for our discussion, a book he co-authored with Davida Isaacs titled Patents for Power, Intellectual Property in the Diffusion of Military Technology. You can find that link over at our home blogs and all the pre-show announcements if you want to go check it out. Now, Rob at the moment teaches national security courses at the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky. His interests lie in maritime history, air power theory, and the politics of national defense. Rob, welcome back to Midrats.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here again.
We are very happy to spend a little bit of our afternoon with you. And I think just kind of to kick it off, kind of a broad-ranging questions for those that know people who are in the law area. No, you can always tease patent attorneys because patents, intellectual property, it's an esoteric part of law, but it can get tough because you're dealing with lots of money, lots of ideas, lots of potential there. And what brought you to the topic of intellectual property and patents and how it ties into national security?
Well, it's a really good question, and it was a really idiosyncratic journey. So, you know, for a long time, I've been interested in how knowledge moves in the international security sphere. So, you know, why a particular military organization will adopt a kind of doctrine that it's borrowed from a different country, or I did some stuff in my dissertation on, like, transferring anti-submarine warfare knowledge between the United States and the United Kingdom during World War II. So I was always sort of attuned to this question of, you know, how does knowledge move in the military sphere? And then, you know, as it happened, I married a patent attorney. And so she was working on, and that's my co-author, Davida Isaacs. She was working on some work that was associated with a dispute between Zoltek and the United States government, in which there was a question of the ownership of certain patents. And from there, we just sort of picked it up. I think one of the earliest things we watched the movie Iron Man 2, if you can reach as far back in your mind and remember Iron Man 2, where the U.S. government attempts to take away all of the trade secrets and patents and everything associated with the Iron Man suit from Tony Stark. And so that sparked some thinking about, okay, well, you know, how much is there really here in terms of a research agenda on intellectual property protection, and the national security sphere? And so, you know, long story short, what we found was that there's really a lot of different interesting angles on how patent law, trade secret law, and national security interact. And it really goes back, a very long time. Like some of the earliest patents are built around things that we would now define as, you know, basic national security concerns. So, you know, overall, it seemed pretty esoteric and it seemed pretty minimal, but it ended up being, I think, a really big question. And I think it's also one that it's become evident how big of a topic it is now, because it's sort of at the core of our argument with China.
Well, let's go into some basics here. We talked about intellectual property. Let's talk about what that consists of and why it is protected, and how it can be stolen or otherwise used by somebody who may be interested in acquiring the knowledge without having to pay for it.
Yeah. So, well, I'm not the lawyer, and so some of the lawyers here, I think, will, you know, undoubtedly quibble with aspects of how I'm defining this. But the two kinds of intellectual property that we really look at in the book are patent protection and trade secret. Patent protection is usually something that is conventional, so it's in the, I believe it's constitutional in the United States. But it essentially gives a particular inventor or company or government organization, whoever owns it, the right to sort of a monopoly profit over the invention for a particular amount of time. And it can be owned by any kind, any number of different organizations. It can be licensed out. Basically, what it is designed to do is to provide people incentives to innovate, to devote their time and effort and capital to coming up with new innovations. But it's also intended to give people protection in case they want to share certain kinds of knowledge and certain kinds of inventions, right? So if you want to license it to somebody else or some other company, the patent protects your interest in the particular technology that you've developed. And patents are public, right? Or many of them are public, as we know, as we will see with respect to national security. Some of them can be made secret by the government, but essentially it's public. They're at a big public office, and you can go and look at all sorts of interesting patents over time. But essentially, they're there to give people monopoly rights to the profits over a particular kind of invention. They've been used for different things over time. And we'll probably talk about this a little bit. They actually played a role in the making of the atomic bomb and in keeping the making of the atomic bomb secret. But we'll get to that. The other main area in which intellectual property protection, as is relevant to national security, happens is in trade secret protection. And trade secrets essentially are some sort of process or technique or mechanism by which a person or company or whatever else produces a good. And so trade secret protection, you don't tell the government about the trade secret, because then it would be something that could be appropriated. But nevertheless, the state provides protection for your trade secrets in case someone else, in some effort to do industrial espionage, attempts to steal the knowledge that you use in order to produce the good that you're producing. And so in national security, as you can probably imagine, trade secrets come up a lot with respect to how particular companies are producing a piece of equipment or a piece of technology, or how countries are trying to protect how particular processes work and prevent other countries and other companies from getting a hold of those. There are other parts of national security, or there are other parts of intellectual property protection. Most of them aren't super relevant, like copyright and trademark and so forth, aren't super relevant to the national security sphere, even if they interact in certain ways. There are some issues with software, sort of how software can be protected using some kinds of intellectual property law. I've even seen one argument that you could use the same techniques that, say, Honda uses to protect the layout of the inside of an automobile. You could use that to provide protection for the layout of an F-35. The internal layout of an F-35, the ergonomics, if you will, of an F-35. But I'm not sure that's ever been operationalized. So mainly we're talking about patents and trade secrets.
One of the phrases that really had me go down all sorts of little rabbit holes is when people think about intellectual property protection, normal people that are just your standard issue American who work in business, perhaps they haven't traveled or lived abroad. The world extends rarely besides their Facebook group or their area code. They don't realize that this is a great, wide, and diverse world, and different cultures and different nations, different economic systems have a different connection to the rules of laws and procedures. And one of the phrases used in the book is the compliance gap, which I thought was a very efficient way of describing how things can vary from nation to nation about what they may have on the books or agree to and how they actually function. How does that cultural difference or understanding of compliance gaps complement the protection of international property when you're working in the global world that we are today?
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. And it's one of the things I knew almost nothing about with respect to intellectual property before, you know, we started writing this book. One of the things that really surprised me, because in the book we take a look at some other countries and what their intellectual property protection looks like. So we take a look at the Soviet Union, we take a look at the People's Republic of China, we take a look at South Korea. Compliance gap happens in a couple different ways, right? On the one hand, you have countries that are pretty disinterested in following through on protecting anybody's intellectual property. And so the Soviet Union is a great example, right, that they just didn't have much interest in doing it. And then sort of the South Koreans and the Chinese didn't really have a culture of intellectual property protection. I mean, it's almost not evident in Chinese culture any sort of idea, a pre-modern idea, that knowledge should be protected in this particular way. There are much different norms of how knowledge is shared and what it means to share knowledge. And this had some really interesting effects because, you know, on the one hand, the Soviet Union, which is this communist country, right, which is hostile to the very notion of private property, nevertheless remains basically compliant with all of the big intellectual property treaties that Imperial Russia signed. And so you had privately owned patents and company-owned patents in the Soviet Union for almost the entire existence of the USSR, because there was still sort of this culture and this understanding. And eventually the Soviets begin to be, you know, enforcers of certain kinds of intellectual property because, you know, Solzhenitsyn and other authors are selling tons of copies outside the USSR. And eventually the Russians, well, you know, we need to get in on this, right? This is our money. And they start sort of adopting you know, major components of international intellectual property protection law. You know, it still doesn't make a big difference in terms of their economy because nobody has any capital that they can, you know, invest in any of the inventions, but they do have patent systems. And on the military side, what the Russians have are, you know, they reward particular labs and particular design bureaus based on how many patents they generate in a particular time. And so it creates this weird sort of incentive structure. But what you don't have really is the compliance gap, right? The Soviets are complying with a lot of the rules that they're supposed to be complying with, not so much on the national security side, but on the civilian side, they're actually, you know, they're not a horrible intellectual property citizen. Whereas with the Chinese and the Koreans, it's much more of a struggle to sort of create this culture of compliance in these countries where there is not historically this understanding that you got to protect certain kinds of knowledge in order to produce the kind of effects you want. And so the Chinese, for example, and this is what's really fascinating to me, they tried to develop a military-industrial complex without any kind of patent protection, which was a complete disjuncture even from what the Soviets were doing. And what they found was that they had all these labs and design bureaus, and no one would share anything with anyone else. And so innovation slowed way, way, way down based on the inability of anybody to protect the knowledge they were creating, which then meant that you couldn't share anything with any other design bureau. With the Koreans, the Koreans are more involved with the international economy, and so they have to be compliant much more than the Chinese are from an earlier period, but you still have some of the same issues. But yeah, the big question is like, okay, you know, how many of these countries are signed on to saying they're going to respect intellectual property law, and how close do they come to actually respecting intellectual property protection? And the answer varies based on culture, based on, you know, what the interests of the country are and what its relationship with the United States is. But yeah, there's a lot of interesting, really interesting variation on how these countries are really sort of honoring what the international law on intellectual property protection is becoming.
Yeah, I just always have loved the phrase international law. I mean, being an attorney, maybe I'm a little cynical about it, but what can't be enforced might as well not be written. And I think one of the interesting aspects of your book was the discussion of the sort of, I want to call them ad hoc, but probably isn't the right word either, but enforcement mechanisms which have sprung up as a result of various treaties and the contractual obligations of the parties involved. Can you kind of discuss how this particular branch of international law is enforced to the extent it is?
Yeah, sort of. I mean, there are sort of two or three big things that are intersecting. You know, on the one hand, after World War II, the United States creates a system of export controls that it basically is able to enforce on all of its allies that apply to the transfer of certain kinds of high technology goods. And this is sort of piggybacks on the existing intellectual property system in the United States, but it's the way in which the United States was able to prevent major technologies from being exported to the Soviet Union and to countries that were allied with the Soviet Union. And in a lot of ways, that still exists. And other countries have sort of stepped up and taken advantage of that, and we can see that. You know, it's one of the reasons why Lockheed Martin can't export certain kinds of technologies to South Korea, because we're worried that the South Koreans will steal them, right? And so the State Department says no. It's the reason why Korean Aerospace Industries can't export certain aircraft to Uzbekistan or to Tajikistan, because Lockheed Martin owns part of those, owns some of the intellectual property associated with those. And so, using U.S. law in conjunction with Korean law, we can essentially tell South Korea no, you can't. under this conjunction of Swedish and British law, you can't do that, right? And so it's a really effective way of shutting down, you know, when you own a little bit of every military technology in the world, it's a really effective way of shutting everything down. So that's been there for a while. But especially in the 1990s, and there's a wonderful book by a scholar named Susan Sell, and you know the name of it just very briefly escapes me, but I'll try to remember by the end of the show, who talked about how intellectual property protection became part of all the really big legal institutions that managed international trade. And so this became TRIPS, which is tariff-related. Anyway, everybody called it TRIPS, T-R-I-P-S, and becomes part of the WTO and essentially takes what is major Western intellectual property law and begins to start enforcing it on an international basis, right? So it creates real penalties for countries to violate the patent rights and the trade secret rights of especially American, but also European, Japanese companies. And you guys remember that movie with Aaron Eckhart where he talks about the merchants of death. And he is, I can't remember if he's guns or smoking. I guess, no, thank you for not smoking. So he's on the smoking side. Anyway, reading about this process, I mean, I study arms, right? I study weapons. And so I'd always thought of myself as somebody who studied merchants of death. But you read about, you know, the big agricultural companies, the big pharmaceutical companies. It wasn't Lockheed Martin that was pushing this really constraining vision of intellectual property protection or Raytheon or anyone else. It was the agricultural giants and the pharmaceutical giants that were basically shutting down the expansion of certain kinds of technology on seeds, on agriculture, on drugs. Essentially, these companies are stepping up and using IP law to make sure that Brazil and India and other countries couldn't use the most productive seeds, couldn't use the most productive drugs without paying for them. And so that's kind of where the structure of intellectual property law that is now part of the WTO, and it basically informs how most countries now deal with intellectual property protection. It doesn't come from U.S. military stuff. It comes from pharmaceuticals. It comes from agribusiness. But it's now being layered onto how defense and defense technology gets sold around the world. So in a way, kind of the pharmaceuticals and the agricultural were leading the way. And now you have some of the same mechanisms of enforcement. You have the same mechanisms of sort of norm setting that led the way there being applied to a lot of dual-use technologies and technologies that are being applied in the national security sphere. And that, you know, you can ignore all of this stuff entirely if you're a country, but there are downsides. If you ignore people's intellectual property rights, there are arbitration mechanisms were a huge part of the big Pacific trade organization, basically the big Pacific trading arrangement that failed. But the United States has also taken steps to enforce arbitration rights, to enforce intellectual property rights, and basically every trade arrangement we've signed now. And a lot of that comes from this development of international law.
I thought, especially for a guy who has enjoyed shooting firearms since I was a grade schooler, I got a kick out of the hook that you had in the introduction, because when you get a few gun guys around a table and you bring up the old AK-47 versus M16 scenario, Bill immediately, you know, talk about, well, you know, the AK-47 is so much more popular because it's easier to maintain, it doesn't jam as much, it's more rugged, dot, dot, dot. And there's more to the story there about popularity, the number of different manufacturers that it does, that has less to do with it going bang every time you pull the trigger, but something, at least for those that are intellectuals, something a little more different. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and how that can help people view what shows up on the battlefield that might not have anything to do with utility?
Yeah, I mean, so it was a great example. And first, you know, let me hasten to say, the intellectual property story on the AK-47 and the M16 is not the only part of this angle, right? The weapons are much different. There are reasons why the AK is more popular. But, you know, a big part of the reason there are so many more AKs than there are M16s is that the AKs and the designs of the AKs were sent along to countries that, you know, utterly indifferent to intellectual property rights. It's not just China, although China is the biggest offender on this. It's also North Korea, where the Soviets are basically giving away the store on how to design and how to manufacture these things. And the Chinese are completely disrespectful of the actual Soviet, any sort of Soviet property rights to the particular kinds of weapon. And it's not just the AK, it's also the MiG-21. It's a few other kinds of weapon over time that the Chinese are basically just appropriating. But yeah, part of the story here is a legal story, right? That the United States and Armalite, firms within the United States have particular rights to protect the AR-15, M16, right, in ways that Kalashnikov doesn't really have many rights at all to the weapon that he helps design. But essentially the design bureau that produces the AK-47 doesn't have the ability to tell other people, you can't make this, right? And because it doesn't, you get countries around the world, whether they started Soviet allies or like the Chinese did, or they're never quite Soviet allies. You know, once you have just the basic design process down and the basic manufacturing process down, you don't have to worry about anyone coming and suing you for building these things, right? You don't have to worry about paying any kind of licensing fee for building these things. Whereas with respect to the United States, right, there's a whole bevy of intellectual property rights that's tied up with the particular firearm. There have to be licensing arrangements that are carefully monitored. And then this is one of the reasons why you have, you know, some, you know, calculable number of M16s that are produced and some huge number of AK-47s and the family of AK-47s that are spread around the world, because you know, the knowledge is free. It's not protected in the way that the knowledge is protected in the United States. And this was just one where, you know, I had just never really thought about it that way until I started thinking about, and we started thinking about, how the protection of intellectual property is going to affect how weapons move around the world, how technologies move around the world, and the sort of defense choices that countries are going to make when they're faced with similar problems. But it's part of the story. It's not all of the story. You know, obviously the M16 AK-47 story is a gigantic story that has spawned many books, but it's definitely part of what's going on in this story.
Let's work with that a little bit, because as I was reading the book and you were talking about the effect of intellectual property on innovation, I will use the M16, AK-47. Which route leads to more innovation? The protection of by Colt and Armalite of the M16, or this loosey goosey? We're going to just throw it out there and see who wants to build them. Approach the AK-47. Which system, if you get a feel for this, is more, you know, allows for other people to come in and innovate based off the design? I mean, I've shot a few AK-47s, and they seem to be all pretty much the same. But you know, we get so many varieties of other weapons out of the in challenge the M16. Which way is inducing more innovation and thus helping spread more intellectual property around the world?
You know, that is a supremely good question. And, you know, unfortunately, the answer in all of the scholarship is still that we do not, you know, a lot of it depends on context. And some of it we just don't quite know. You know, the literature, the economic literature, you know, lots of economists have tried to study how patents actually affect technological innovation. And the answers are that it's really unclear how patent protection affects technological innovation. And we know we can test this in a lot of ways because, you know, countries have adopted much more robust systems of IP protection. And then you look and see, well, what's actually going on? And the answer is, you know, it's not a lot more innovation that's happening. So Japan, for example, which in the 80s adopts a much more robust IP system, South Korea adopts a more robust IP system. You don't necessarily see an explosion of innovation coming out of those countries. On the contrary, right, we have examples like the Chinese example where, you know, we can point to and say, look, there are major problems in this innovation, in this national innovation system, which are really slowing things down because there's no way for people to protect their stuff, right? Because basically when there's no intellectual property protection, all there is trade secret protection. And if all you have is trade secret protection, then you never really lend out techniques. You never really lend out and license out forms of knowledge. And that really does seem to slow stuff down. It slowed the Chinese down, and it seems to slow some other stuff down. You know, even the sort of patent system that the Soviets had, you know, it provided an incentive for innovation, right? I mean, the design bureaus were being awarded all kinds of patents, and that was prestige in the Soviet system, and it seemed to have had an effect on the way that the Soviets were innovating. You know, to summarize as well as we could, sort of what the impact of, you know, real serious patent protection is on innovation overall. You know, real robust patent protection seems more to generate what we would think of as disruptive innovations, right? It tends to encourage collaboration between civilian parts of the economy and military parts of the economy that then generates, you know, sort of really disruptive and interesting technologies between those two. The lack of patent protection, on the other hand, tends to work pretty solidly for what we would call sustaining innovations. And sustaining innovations are the sort of thing that the Soviets were always really, really good at, right? So take a thing, so whether it's a MiG-21 or an AK-47, and just subtly and slowly improve it over the lifestyle of the system. Patent protection often seems to kind of get in the way of that kind of innovation because it creates roadblocks between different kinds of firms, different kinds of agencies, and slows things down. I know that sounds really, really squishy and touchy-feely, but I'm telling you, reading lots and lots of work on how patents work, you know, even patent attorneys and certainly the economists of patents do not agree on whether patents are at all good for technology innovation. Right? There's huge disagreement on these points. Just like one area, especially in the United States, where patents play a big role in the story and really slow things down, is with respect to aircraft development. So a few of the listeners are probably going to be familiar with the Wright patent wars, in which the Wright brothers controlled a few key patents and were willing to litigate all of them pretty viciously against other aircraft producers in the United States. And these came down to whether a wing can move, which basically the Wrights interpreted as if a wing moves in any way, including, you know, flaps, ailerons, anything like that, then it belongs to the Wright brothers. And so there's pretty substantial agreement that they really slowed down innovation and production in the United States of aircraft, whereas in Europe you had a bunch of countries that either just blew through it or they bought all the accurate and the correct patents. and were able to produce, you know, much more innovative technologies, such that by 1916, 1917, you know, basically every country in Europe that is a serious, you know, military power has much more advanced aircraft than the United States, where in the U.S., the Wright brothers and Glenn Curtiss are still fighting with one another.
It's funny thinking about the Wright brothers as the original gangster patent trolls, but it's funny how that can it can gum up the works. And it almost seems like that period of time, if not a more innocent time, it most surely wasn't, but it was a quaint time when, especially in the West, when it came to the rule of law. That's the same period of time that after not being too happy with our performance in the Spanish-American War, our Springfield 1903 was such an outright copy in many part ways as the Mauser. We had to pay Germany's Mauser some fees for their designs. And you also had the situation with, in spite of war and everything else, wireless and Marconi and hesitancy to move forward with wireless radio because of patents held by Marconi. Do we still have that type of an international respect for the rule of law that we did, or at least what appears existed 100 years ago? Is this more of a wild, wild west when it comes to that type of technology? What type of transnational legal success have people had recently that could either promote or have people shrug at having that same type of respect for other people's property?
Well, I mean, there has been a lot of success in sort of we're country A, right, United States. Other countries have adopted, you know, whether by treaty or because they need to trade with us in some fashion. They have adopted, you know, a set of intellectual property practices which are fundamentally in accord with ours, right? So they basically are importing a big structure of U.S. law or at least U.S. compliant law. And then, you know, whether we say it's Vietnam or somewhere else, right, somebody in Vietnam nevertheless violates a U.S. patent, violates some form of intellectual property. You know, companies in the United States have had a fair amount of success prosecuting under host country law, right, sort of using host country law after these countries, you know, have clearly agreed to protect intellectual property in a particular way and have that law on their books that, you know, U.S. companies, U.S. firms, are, you know, operating on the private side have been, you know, relatively successful in a lot of places, you know, actually making things happen. You know, another good case is sort of the U.S. relationship with South Korea. And if you follow sort of how the United States and South Korea have interacted, especially in intellectual property issues, South Korea might, and I'm going to get myself in trouble here, but South Korea might be the industrial country least respectful in the world of sort of general norms of intellectual property. I think people would probably, a lot of people sort of in the security sphere might tap South Korea as being not exactly a bad citizen, but the least good citizen. And so, you know, we have certainly pushed South Korea, and South Korea has changed its policy sort of based on the threats that the United States makes, based on the threat of sort of U.S. action against particular South Korean firms. But one of the weird ways that they've reacted has not sort of been saying, okay, well, we're not going to copy any of your stuff and it's fine. You know, we won't try to sell tanks or aircraft or whatever. What instead that they have really done is saying, all right, we are going to set up a parallel process for developing the stuff that we buy from you that is hived off from the stuff we're actually buying so that we can fully own all of the intellectual property rights to it, right? So it's a normal armored personnel carrier or a medium battle tank, whatever, that they're producing. But they are taking great care to ensure that every component in that system is something that they can, with a straight face, say they invented, right? And when Americans then look at it and say, you know, it looks a lot like the thing that we sold you, and the South Koreans say, no, well, I mean, it may look that way, but in fact, we invented it ourselves. That then enables them to sell sort of wherever they want in the world without having to essentially go to the U.S. State Department for permission. And so, you know, that's not exactly the wild, wild west, but it's definitely a way to get around what their legal obligations are, right? The law is clearly important to them. They take great care in getting around those obligations. And you can see some of that in some other countries as well, but South Korea is sort of the paradigmatic example of that.
Well, if the concern is to constrain the spread of certain weapon systems, there's also an effort in almost every country on the face of the earth to engage in various kinds of behavior to get the information they need to produce weapon systems or counter weapon systems. And some of that, you know, we don't frown upon all that. I mean, there's, I think even in the book you identify industrial espionage, we've got cyber espionage or whatever. And then there's the old fashioned way of like Russia did with our B-29s that happened to end up in their hands, you know, reverse engineering. Can you kind of run through those things and is there, I mean, how much of this stuff is we just expect as normal behavior because of the way the world works, and how much of that is just they're trying to build up an industry where, you know, like Korea, where they get into the international arms sales business and start spreading their weaponry around?
Yeah, so, you know, I like to think about this in terms of some of sort of the most famous movies of the late Cold War. There are two in particular. One of them is Firefox, which is, you know, the classic Clint Eastwood where he must think in Russian and he steals a Russian plane. And the other is Hunt for Red October, right, where, you know, we acquire several billion rubles worth of Soviet state property because it has cool technology in it. You know, the official U.S. position is that industrial espionage is, and especially industrial espionage as related to the national security sphere, is, if not fine and above board, at least understandable if what it does is to generate a new understanding of what an enemy's capabilities are, right? So if the Chinese come and they steal a bunch of stuff about the F-35, and we go and we steal a bunch of stuff about the J-20, and all we're really trying to do is to figure out how the J-20 works so that we can shoot it down, or how they figure out how the F-35 works so that they can shoot it down, right? That is regrettable, but that is, in fact, what countries do to one another, right? The U.S. complaint about the Chinese and historically the complaint about the Russians has been that they are not necessarily trying to steal our technology so that they can figure out how to deal with it, although that's part of what they're doing. But rather what China is doing is that official state organs are attacking U.S. privately owned firms, right? So this would be the big defense giants. They would also be law firms that do intellectual property. They would be subcontractors that produce certain components of a weapon system. What the Chinese are doing is that Chinese intelligence agencies are stealing information and technology, intellectual property, from American companies and are then turning that information over to Chinese either state-owned industries or Chinese private companies. And so they are basically, the Chinese government is intentionally facilitating the theft of intellectual property so that its companies will be able to profit at the expense of American companies. And how this plays out in the defense sphere is, you know, say down the road when they try to turn the J-31, their second stealth fighter, into an export platform, and the J-31 has components of the F-35, right? Stuff that they have stolen from Lockheed and from Lockheed's or subcontractors, and then get handed to a Chinese state-owned industry or Chinese subcontractors who are privately owned, so that they can make a profit off of what the United States has invented. So this is the way that the U.S. government has framed the problem of intellectual property theft in the military sphere in the United States, or between the United States and China. Right? It's not just that the Chinese are stealing things, which, you know, whatever, is as old as history. It's that they are taking advantage of the particular structure of the United States defense industrial base. They're attacking at its weak points, and then they're making money off the stuff that they steal, and that money is being taken out of the mouths of Raytheon and Lockheed Martin. And so that's sort of what's new and exciting and interesting about the way that China is doing cyber espionage. Now, you know, we know that there's still a lot of older kinds of intellectual property theft, like the theft of the B-29 and so forth, and reverse engineering. But that stuff is often really, really hard to do. Like reverse engineering with modern technology is really, really hard, like if you want to reverse engineer a whole system. But, you know, stealing bits and pieces of a foreign system and then incorporating in your own stuff, that's something that's potentially lucrative, and that's what we complain about as the United States.
I had a few technical problems on that. I wanted to go back to when you mentioned I believe it was actually one of the questions my co-host asked, talking about the B-29. And we were talking also earlier about, you alluded to some of the nuclear age classification and patent issues. And there's also a danger when you look at intellectual property and classifications that it can be abused. Two cases you mentioned, one involved a smaller company that had an innovative underwater coupling that was being used and may still be used for classified purposes, but also, tragically, Three Widows who were prevented from achieving some semblance of justice from the death of their husband in a 1953 B-29 crash. Is that a significant problem that you see with some of the intellectual property and classification that we see in the defense industry? The abuse?
Yeah, so to talk a little bit about the first one there, and yeah, somebody send me a text or something. I'm looking at the live chat right now in case I break out I'm not talking anymore. You know, the modern U.S. defense industry is not just really big places like Raytheon and Lockheed Martin, right? I mean, basically, you know, as we know, the big defense giants in the United States are, you know, they're fundamentally just sort of systems aggregators, right? They put together technologies that are produced by tons and tons of smaller companies. And it turns out that the way we do classification in the United States, the way that there's such a thing as secret patents, there are sort of ways in which we can prevent certain evidence from reaching a trial, that some companies are more adept than others. I would hesitate to say something like cheating, but getting a major advantage over other firms, basically using the classification system. You know, the point that you alluded to on the coupler was that you had a small firm that had created this underwater coupler like a tennis ball, and bigger company came and said, we want to partner with you on this. It's like, okay, that's awesome. The bigger firm then goes to the Navy and says, look, we created this thing. Big firm then goes back to the small firm and says, okay, you can have this much money. Small firm's like, what? And the big firm is like, you know, good luck, sue us. And then it ends up that during suit, they aren't even allowed discovery on whether or not the technology is being used at all. And especially given that it has been the one of the sort of the major priorities of the Department of Defense since before the Rumsfeld era, that we need to bring small companies into the defense industrial base. It's a big problem when small companies cannot use the legal remedies that they need to in order to be treated fairly by the major contractors. And so the way the intellectual property law happens, the way that secrecy is used in the defense sphere, right, it completely makes sense why it would want, we'd want to keep it secret how we tap underwater cables. But keeping that secret then enables certain bad actors to essentially screw over the people that they're working with. And that sort of chases away and potentially scares people away from participating in the defense industrial base.
Well, let's talk about one famous patent matter that has to do with the atomic weapons that we developed during the course of World War II. I mean, there's a case, I guess, where it made a lot of sense to have secret patents. Can you kind of discuss that?
Yeah, so I've had the great fortune of being able to reread Richard Rhodes' wonderful Making of the Atomic Bomb. And one of the things that's happening in this book as the sort of nuclear technology is developed is there's a huge controversy, especially as it becomes more clear in the by the late 1930s, that the possibility for a bomb is there, right? There might be the possibility for building this tremendously useful explosive. And Leo Szilard, in particular, is really sensitive to the threat that the Germans might develop such a bomb. And, you know, they're following along in all of these journals. And Szilard, one of the things he does, which is sort of viewed askance by, you know, lots and lots of the other scientists, is he begins taking out patents on a lot of different inventions and ideas that are associated with the development of the atomic bomb, right? And the reason that he is patenting these particular processes, these particular technologies, is so that he will have some legal ability to prevent their spread to other actors, right? It gives him, right, his ownership of a patent gives him the right to manage the technology in particular ways that then slow down potentially the transfer of information to other countries, right? And so he does this in conjunction with the British government. He does this in conjunction with the American government. You know, his ownership of these patents that essentially buys his way into the atomic bomb project. It's really after World War II that, especially with respect to atomic weapons, but then also with respect to other sorts of technologies, that you start getting, you know, much more expansive use of secrecy in patents, right? Where you can patent something, but, you know, the government may own a component of it, and then that patent is secret, right? It's not something that is available at the U.S. patent office that you can just go and see. But if it's associated with national security, you can keep it secret. You know, as you say, it makes a lot of sense when you're trying to keep the Nazis from developing an atomic bomb. It may make less sense when you're trying to prevent people from finding out why a B-29 crashed, or you know, why something else happened that was bad, because it gives the government a way of essentially obfuscating any kind of research into its activities.
I don't know where Sal is gone, but I'll ask you the question that we always ask you into the show. I know we're coming down about 5 minutes, so do you have some work that our listeners can pick up on, and anything else you'd like to tell us about what you're working on and when we can see that?
Yeah, I will send along. I have a page that's dedicated to the book, but also to a lot of other work And I'll send that. I'll actually post it in the comments, but also send it along to you guys. One of my favorite books reading about this subject, and it makes sense for a maritime audience, is a wonderful book called Torpedo by Catherine Epstein, which came out in 2014, and which basically argued that, you know, the development of intellectual property law in the United States went hand in hand with the foundation of the modern military-industrial complex. Because what happened together at the same time was that individual inventors, especially on the naval side, were no longer able to accumulate the capital to invent something and then sell it to the Navy, right? Every kind of technology people were inventing was something that you needed investment and you needed a guaranteed purchase from the government for. And so what becomes modern intellectual property protection and the military-industrial complex come together at this time where they are trying to figure out how do we decide on the ownership of the ideas that are being generated in industry, and how do we share that ownership between, you know, private firms and private inventors and the government. And this, you know, then has a huge ripple effect on how the United States does intellectual property protection, but also on how the U.S. Military-industrial complex, defense industrial base, come together. But, you know, there's lots of other work. I mean, Lawrence Goldstone has a wonderful book called Birdman about the Wright brothers. Mara Histindahl has a wonderful book called The Scientist and the Spy, which is really, really readable. And it's about Chinese espionage in the agribusiness sector. So if you like seeds and Iowa, you'll like that. There's a lot of really interesting work coming out right now. James Hashik has wonderful work on the defense side about this kind of stuff. So there's a lot to recommend.
Well, and you've got, in addition to this book, what else are you working on? Some other stuff we can look forward to?
Yeah, I mean, I have a few short articles and some other stuff. You know, once I finish a project, I like to move on to something different because my brain is just broken after doing it. So, you know, I went like 3 years without reading any air power stuff after finishing the Air Force book that I did. And that was great. That was really pleasant. So I think the next thing I'm working on is something with regards to finance, but you know, certainly doing a lot of talk about the patent thing for now.
Well, Rob, we wish you the best of luck with the book. Really enjoy the
that we get people's puzzling a bit, and look forward to the next opportunity to talk to you.
Well, it is always a delight, gentlemen.
Yes, sir. And thank you very much, everybody, for joining us for another edition of MidRats. And until next time, I hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.
Molly wrote a neat reply to Irish Paddy O'Neill, saying Mike Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly.